you find us week two of an 8-week series. It's a mammoth one called The True Image Revealed. And essentially what we are running through is there are seven I am sayings and seven signs within the Gospel of John, which point towards something of God's being, something of his doing. And therefore we're answering the question, what does that mean for us? So when we see something of God, when we see the things that he does, what does that mean about our identity? What does that mean for the kind of people that we're called to be? So Pete kicked us off last week, and he was talking about this idea that John's gospel, there are four accounts of Jesus' life in the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these gospels, and John is really incredibly unique. It's richly symbolic. There are things in it which don't exist in any of the other Gospels. There are ways that the story is told in ways that are deeper and more rich than we would perhaps be able to understand when we just read it for the first time in the way that we might with some of the other Gospels. So it probably takes a little bit of harder work. It takes a little bit of effort to try and understand what's going on. But that's the task that we're on over these next few weeks. It's richly symbolic. It's beautifully poetic. And we have to read it with these two lenses on. So Pete spoke last week about this idea that, yes, we can get so much richness just from the text. Like when we look at the text and when we see the kinds of stories that it's telling, what that means for us, there is so much we can get from that, and we should absolutely do that. But there's something deeper than that. When we scratch beneath the surface, when we use that second lens, there's something so much more that we can get from John. And we're trying to answer both those questions as we go through it. So Pete last week showed us this. He said that God's being leads to God's doing. God's doing leads to our being. And our being leads to our doing. In other words, the person that God is, the person that Jesus is, his very being, his very identity, leads to the kinds of things that he does. That we get glimpses of the kind of his mission on earth when he was here. The way that he's acting around us now, the way that he acts all throughout scripture, all throughout our story. And those things lead to our very identity. They lead to the kind of people that we are, the kind of things that we're named, the kind of things that we are called to be known by. And those things lead to the things that we're supposed to do. In other words, our mission. Like, what are the kinds of people that we're supposed to be? What does it look like to act out this life of discipleship, this life of following Jesus, following the person of God? And we said that there are in this gospel seven I am sayings. Jesus says time and time again, I am something. I'm the gate. I'm a good shepherd. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. I'm the resurrection, all sorts of stuff. Tonight we're going to be looking at I'm the true vine. And what's special about this is in Exodus 3, right at the beginning of the story, Moses, who's leading the Jewish people, he's standing on a mountain and he says, who is this God? What is his name? It's a pivotal moment. It's one of the most quoted parts of the Bible by the Bible, which probably means that it's worth listening out for. It's worth paying attention to. And God just says, I am. His name is I am. I am who I am. There's various ways you can translate it. And what Jesus is doing all throughout this gospel is he's looking back to that and he's hinting back to that and he's saying, I am. In other words, I am God, standing right in front of you, I am. And then he goes on to suggest a number of characteristics about himself, what that means for the people that he's in front of. There are also seven signs. We said there's seven I am sayings, but there's also seven signs. There's seven kind of miracles, incredible moments of breakthrough that happen in the Gospel of John. And these things we're trying to link up together, some more easily than others. My one, I'd like to think, is easier than some of the others. But we will find out shortly. And these seven signs, they all add up to this statement right at the end of the gospel. This is how the gospel finishes. So the person who wrote it, John, he writes this thing and he says, Jesus performed many other signs. So not just these seven, many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these things are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. In other words, he's giving us a huge hint. Not just a hint, he's smacking us around the face and saying, these things are in front of you because they're pointing towards something way bigger than just the sign, than just the miracle that's happening in front of you. It's so that you might believe that he's the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you might have life in his name and life to all its fullness. That is what we're supposed to do when we read this stuff. We're supposed to be allowed into this story, to be drawn into what God is doing, to be drawn into the fact that he is present, he's alive, he's Jesus in front of us. So Pete talked us through this. He said God's being, God's doing, our being and our doing. And this idea of if we want to see culture renewed, we talk about that quite a lot, Casey. If we want to see change around us, We need to go on this journey. More than that, if we want to, we're calling this the art of becoming, this idea of becoming more and more like Jesus. We want to become disciples. It's why we take this stuff so seriously. It's why we have pattern hubs, all this kind of stuff. We want to become more and more the people that Jesus is calling us to be. We need to first go back. We need to understand, who is God? Who does God say he is? More than that, what does he do? And therefore, what does that mean for us? So that's what we're doing. We're going through this series. And this week, we're going to be looking at the two parts of John. One is where he says, I am the true vine. And we're going to unpack some of that. And then more than that, right at the beginning of the gospel, we see Jesus do this incredible miracle where he turns water into wine. So I'm just going to invite Jules up, if that's all right. She's going to read these two accounts. Let's give Jules a round of applause. So maybe you've got a Bible in front of you, or you might in fact have the little John's Gospel that you had last week. You probably won't have that in front of you, but if you don't, either way, use the Bible, get the app, follow these two things. So John 15 and John 2, take it away.
Thank you. So this is John 15, verses 1 to 9. I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, so that it will be even more fruitful. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me as I also remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. You must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If you do not remain in me, you are like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish and it will be done for you. This is to my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. And then the other one. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 80 to 120 liters. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him.
Amazing. Thanks, Jules. She just said it's sweaty. It's actually my sweat from the first time I handed it to her. But anyway, thanks so much, Jules. That's awesome. So the first thing to say before we go into any of these passages is that there is so much richness in these two things that I'm absolutely not going to give it justice. Books have been written, hours have been debated, all of that kind of stuff of what's going on in here. But we're going to just try and touch on the surface what's going on and what that might mean for us. So we're going to start with the tree vine. So go flick back to John chapter 15. And just to give you some context whilst we're doing that, just to kind of fill you in with what's going on, we find ourselves in the room of the Last Supper. So a couple of chapters before the Last Supper has taken place, it's this last meal that Jesus shares with his 12 disciples before he's arrested and eventually killed. We're in this little room with them together. And he's already said that one of those 12 is going to betray him. Judas has left the room at this point. He's the one who betrays him, just to give you the spoiler. And essentially what we have is a download. It's called the Farewell Discourse. It's essentially some teaching where he's giving to the remaining 11 disciples a download of incredibly intense but incredibly rich teaching about who he is, what it means for them, what they're commanded to go and do as his church that he's about to build on. So it's incredible stuff that we're about to get. There's some nuggets in there. And in the middle of it, in the middle of these few chapters, later that night he's going to get arrested. It says, "I am the true vine." He gives this analogy of, "I am the true vine." And for some of us, we're like, okay, that's cool. Like, we can kind of get something on the surface. We probably may have heard this the last, like, if we've been Christians for a while, we've heard this in Sunday school before, whatever, and we kind of think, I get it, I understand it. For them in the room, there would have been incredibly mixed emotions. On the one hand, they kind of, it's probably a really rich, it's quite a profound thing that he's saying, and yet on the other hand, it's incredibly confusing. It doesn't make any sense. It's probably quite frustrating to listen to it because there's questions that come immediately to their minds and they think, that doesn't feel right. That doesn't sound right. So we're going to try and unpack some of that. We're going to go for the second question first, that scratching beneath the surface, like what's going on under the surface, and then we're going to see what we can get just from what's on the surface. But to go under the surface, we have to do a little bit of work. We have to lift the bonnet up on what's going on in this passage, and we're going to do a little bit of theology. So do follow with me as I do it. So on the one hand, it is familiar. This idea of vines and vineyards is incredibly familiar. In first century Palestine, there would have been vines and vineyards everywhere. It would have been that the whole landscape was covered with this stuff. So the idea of something being called that or being labeled that isn't that strange. But what is strange is it was always labeled as the nation of Israel was a vine. So all the way through the Old Testament, all the way through the story of the nation of Israel, Israel is called the vine. Just a few examples. In Psalm 80, it says this, "Restore us, God Almighty, make your face shine on us, that we may be saved. You transplanted a vine from Egypt. You drove out the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground for it, and it took root and filled the land." In other words, God's saying, I took this vine, this nation of Israel, out of Egypt, and I transplanted it into the promised land. That's what he's saying there. One of the prophets, Hosea, says something similar. Israel was a spreading vine. He brought forth fruit for himself. As his fruit increased, he built more altars. As his land prospered, he adorned his sacred stones. Their heart is deceitful, and now they must bear their guilt. In other words, I made this thing called the vine, the nation of Israel, and yet it's being deceitful. It's not doing the things that I asked it to do. Isaiah says something similar. "I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyards. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up, cleared it out of the stones, and planted it in the choicest vines, but it yielded only bad fruit. I put this nation Israel in the choicest of places, and yet it yielded only bad fruit." This kind of gutting, heart-wrenching emotions almost of God that come through in these prophecies. I wanted so much for this thing called Israel. I wanted so much for this vine. I put it in the right place, and yet it yielded bad fruit. So there were two problems. Although they were familiar with it, there were two problems. One is that it was always a nation. It was never an individual. It was always a group. So for him to say, "I'm the vine," is a very strange concept. They're like, "I know kind of what you mean by that, except we're the vine. Like, Israel are the vine. Us Jewish people are the vine. Why are you saying you're the vine, an individual?" So that's the first confusion. The second confusion is that it was always associated with failure and judgment. Like, every time we've read it, it says that they failed. They were called to so much, and yet they delivered so little. There's this heart-wrenching final one in Jeremiah, it says, I had planted you like a choice vine of sound and reliable stock. How then did you turn against me into a corrupt wild vine? An unanswered, horrible question for God to ask through this prophecy. Like, why is it that you turned away from me? I wanted so much from you, and yet you delivered so little. So the fact that he says, I am the vine, and way more than that, that I am the true vine, is incredibly profound. It's an immensely profound thing that he's saying. He's saying that he is the true Israel. The promise is, instead of resting on a group of people, instead of resting on this nation called Israel, instead of using the chosen few to bless the many, it's now everything through me. All of the promises rest on me, a person, Jesus. Everything goes through me. It's no longer the few, it's now the many. Anyone who remains, who has faith in me, is the promised people. And we see it all the way through all of the Gospels. Jesus is not only pointing towards himself as this, he's completely reenacting the journey of Israel, that the journey goes on. As Israel is called out of Egypt into the promised land, we read in Matthew 2, it says, out of Egypt I called my son, is a prophecy that's actually in the Old Testament, but it's named out in Matthew 2 that he fulfills that. He's called out of Egypt, where the nation of Israel go through the Red Sea and they go into wilderness. We see Jesus going through the waters of baptism and he goes for 40 days, 40 nights into the wilderness straight away. Where Moses calls down bread from heaven so that they would eat this manna, this daily thing that would nourish them. Jesus calls down bread from heaven, feeds 5,000 people. He's doing the same things that Israel were doing, where Moses ascends to Mount Sinai and receives the law from God. Jesus goes up the mountain and he gives the law in the Sermon on the Mount. He's doing the exact same thing that Israel is doing, except one huge difference. Where Israel gets it wrong, where they drift off course, Jesus maintains truth to what he's called to do. He's always right. He always gets it right. Where Israel kept kind of getting there and then just going off and veering off and not getting it right, Jesus gets it right every single time. He's saying, I'm the true vine. I'm the true Israel. I'm the true way to God. He's saying, if you remain in me, you are my true people. He's like plainly saying, it's me. Like, look at me, it's me. Every single one of these signs, or every single one of these I am sayings we're going to look at, he's saying so plainly to them, it's me. You're always looking for me. Where before you were looking for something else, you're now looking for me. So it's not just this quirky gardening analogy that we sometimes think that the true vine is. There's so much depth. There's so much hidden meaning within this. But he goes on from that. He doesn't just say something about him. He says, what does it look like for us to be a part of that? What does it look like for us to join in that mission? He says, remain in me. Now, just coincidentally, it's actually really handy. We have a vine in our garden, which is remarkable that we, A, have a garden, and B, that we have a vine in there. And we moved into our house about a year and a half ago, And when we moved in, it was the middle of winter, and there was this scraggly little vine that looked a little bit like that. You can just see it's this one thing going up, and it's fine there. And we figured, like, in our garden, we just let it all grow out for maybe 6 months. We'll see what happened over spring, over summer. You don't want to know, you don't want to kind of cut too much back because you don't know what's going to come. I'm talking about gardening like I know what I'm doing. I really don't. But anyway, Joe decided we weren't going to cut anything back. We were going to see what bloomed so that we'd figured next year what we might cut. I don't really know what I'm talking about. But anyway, what happened was, a few months later, this is what it looked like. So the vine is there on the left-hand side, and it covered the whole corner of our garden. It, like, completely demolished everything else in its path. And you know when suddenly, like, when you live in Zone 1, Zone 2 of London, and you read, I'm the true vine, and it kind of sounds good, and you kind of get it, but then when you see what a vine does, it actually comes to life. It's actually quite exciting stuff. These stories are genuine gold. And the problem is, we have a tendency in our culture to just look after ourselves. We don't want anyone getting involved. We don't want to be joined to something different. We want to look after ourselves. But our problem is, if we do that, we are actually quite self-destructive people, whether we know it or not. If you don't know it, you are self-destructive if left to your own devices. And more than that, not only are you self-destructive, but you're probably destructive of other people. I'm really sorry to break the dream in your head that you're not, but you probably will be, except for when we remain in him. That is what he's trying to say. This vine, when left to its own devices, when not allowed to be pruned, when not allowed to be shaped and made into the vine that it was probably created to be, we just left it. But what it did was it would start rooting in itself. It was all kind of tangly. And more than that, it started taking over every other plant in the garden. It was becoming self-destructive and destructive of all the things around it because we didn't prune it. And more than that, this whole passage, if you go back to it, keeps talking about fruitfulness. I want you to be fruitful, fruitful, fruitful. What we realized when we looked in the summer, there were like four measly grapes. I mean, I know we're not in a great kind of weather, climate, whatever, but four grapes. I mean, that is poor. If we pruned it, which we then did, and now we have probably a little bit more. Do we have a little bit more grapes? Too early to tell. Too early to sell, guys. Anyway, hopefully the analogy will come true. When I do this talk in another few years, I'll be able to say what happened. When we prune us, when we allow God to prune us, when we allow God to prune us, we will see fruit. And more than that, we become not self-destructive. We don't destroy the things that are in our pathway. So the thing that we are called to be is actually branches, as stupid as that sounds. He is saying, you are the branches, I am the vine. Remain in me. We are called to be intrinsically connected, linked with him. And more than that, he says, when you do that, you will be fruitful. You will see stuff happen. And what that means is we're going to start to see the things that Jesus did happen in our own lives. We're going to start to see the very stuff that he does come to reality. John Wimber was an amazing church leader, started the whole Vineyard movement in the US. And he, when he came to faith, he was reading scripture and he was in a church, small church. And he said to the church leader, like, when do we get to do the stuff? And the church was like, what do you mean? He's like, all the stuff that Jesus does, like, this looks really cool. When are we able to actually start doing that? And this is what we're called to. We're called to actually do some of this stuff, but we do this stuff by being intrinsically linked, to being connected with the Father. We do it when we're linked with God and his call over our lives. And I want to suggest that in order that we're fruitful, in order that we're connected, what does it look like to remain? I think it looks like obedience. And we struggle a little bit with that word, and what it means is because we're shaped by our experience of it. And it's actually a word that has gone down in usage an enormous amount. So this is a thing, just some stats for you. Over the last 200 years, this shows you how much the word obedience has come up in any kind of literature. And it's just a steady decline. We're not interested in obedience in the way that we were used to be. We're not interested in the word obedience. There's a little resurgence in the last couple of years. That was probably me just Googling it for this talk. But you realize that we're not interested. Maybe 15% of what we used to use in literature, this word obedience, we use now. Like, we're not interested in obedience. And part of the problem is that we're shaped by our experience of what it looks like to be obedient. Now, we live in a broken world, right? So for many of us, to be obedient looked like to keep away from the threat of what would happen if we weren't obedient. We so often focus on the threat, what will happen if we don't be obedient. Instead, what God is saying is, obedience isn't a threat, obedience is a promise. He's saying, when you stay in me, when you're connected to me, you will see freedom, you'll see fullness of life. More than that, you'll see fruitfulness. We're called to be obedient. The second thing, we're going to switch back to John 2. So if you've got the Bible in front of you, just switch back to John 2, and we're going to look at this example of water into wine, because this is a great outplaying of all of this stuff that we've talked about. We see it in action rather than just in words. So just to reacquaint yourself with the passage, it's right at the start of John's Gospel, chapter 2, and he's just called some of his disciples. And in fact, what's really cool, in the verse just before chapter 2, he says to Nathanael, one of the ones that he has called to be his disciple, he says, I tell you, you will see heaven open. Which is a really cool promise. And not only is it a cool promise, but immediately he sees heaven open. Immediately they are at wedding, in fact. 3 days after he says that, they are at this wedding and they see some incredible stuff happen. So they find themselves at this wedding. Jesus is there, his disciples are there, his mother's there. So it's probably a local gathering. It's probably within the village. All of the people who are surrounding that area will have been invited, which is why they're all there. And before we even get into the story, before we even understand some of the pictures that's going on, before we kind of figure out what's going on with this water and wine, there are three huge spoilers that John gives us that are going to ruin the rest of the gospel, because it's going to be plain who this person Jesus is going to be. The first of which is, it says, on the third day. This whole thing starts with on the third day. Now for us there, we're like, a little bit of detail, not that interesting, third day, helpful. When you look back, it will say a few verses before, it says on the first day in chapter 1, on the next day, on the next day, on the next day, on the third day. And to understand what all of that means, we have to go back to last week. So Pete, when he was talking about the beginning of John's gospel, he said there's this mirroring that's taking place with Genesis 1. So in Genesis 1, the beginning of the story, all of creation, it says, in the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth. In the beginning. And if you look at John 1:1, it says, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. In the beginning. They're meant to mirror each other. In other words, what John is saying at the beginning of this gospel, there's another creation taking place. Like, we've had this creation, and in some strange way, in this person of Jesus, there's a recreation taking place. And if you all know the beginning of the story in Genesis, there are 7 days of creation. And on the seventh one, it says this. On the seventh day, God finished the work that he'd done. He finished the work that he'd done. And that's cool if it said on the seventh day, but it says on the third day, you would have noticed. And I'm just going to try and explain that. What's actually going on is there was the first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day. And then this on the third day means the third after those four, believe me, all the scholars say it. And you realize what this actually is the seventh day after he's been baptized. He's saying this is going to be a foretaste of what it looks like for God's work to be done. This is what it looks like when creation is done. This is what it looks like for heaven to break into earth, what you're about to read. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we're at a wedding. Now, a wedding for us, that sounds cool, that sounds fun. What you realize is there's deep symbolism of unity. There's deep symbolism of community. And more than that, there's deep symbolism of an eternal truth that he's speaking about here. So right at the end of the story, we know we start in a garden, we know we finish with a wedding. We finish with Jesus meeting his bride. It says this in Revelation 19, it says, let us rejoice and exult and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his bride has made herself ready. The Lamb being Jesus and the bride being his church being you and I. In other words, what he's about to do here, he's about to do something extraordinary at a wedding, at the end of creation, the creation narrative. It's pointing towards this incredible eternal truth. He's about to show us what some of that looks like. He's about to hint at what some of that looks like for eternity to break into now. And finally, it says this, nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used for the Jews for ceremonial washing. And again, that probably doesn't sound that exciting to us. Like, we know it's water into wine. We know that he took some jars full of water and he turned it into something extraordinary like wine. But what's amazing here is that this is anything but normal water. This water was put aside so that they would be purified, so that they would be washed when they go for ceremonies, for festivals. What Jesus is implicitly doing here and what John's trying to hint at time and time again is the old doesn't matter anymore. I'm going to turn the old into something incredibly fruitful. I'm going to turn what you used to have to do, the law, into something exciting, something fresh, something which is recreated. That's what he's doing when he's turning the old into the new. So again, we just see this cool story of water into wine and don't realize some of the profound truth that Jesus is saying, some of the stuff that he's hinting at about the very person that he is. Again, he's screaming, it's me. Can you see it's me? All of the things that were in the story of the biblical narrative, it's all pointing towards me. And we look back now and we miss some of that stuff. We need to regain the truth of that it's him. It's all him. And we go back to the story and Jesus' mother said, they have no more wine. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to a wedding where they've run out of something. It is deeply awkward. I have been at one. I was at one recently and I was an usher. And it was a kind of do-it-yourself type wedding where they were on a bit of a tighter budget. So they had some friends doing the catering and then the ushers were the waiters, which in hindsight was an enormous mistake for various reasons, but I'm going to tell you one of them. What happened was we were delivering all the food to all of the people, which was going fine. That people had obviously RSVP'd and said whether they were vegetarian or gluten-free or whatever. And we were taking all the food out to the people and it was going great. We were on to the last table. My job was the last table, table number 7. I remember it well. And what happened was there were 9 people on this table, 1 vegetarian, 8 meat eaters. So I take the 8 plates of meat first, naturally. That's a joke. It's good to be, anyway, it doesn't matter. And I took the ninth plate, which was a vegetarian meal, out. And one of the people who had taken one of the meat things said, oh, I'm really sorry, I'm actually a vegetarian too. I don't know if I let them know, but I'm going to need a vegetarian meal as well. And I'm like, okay, no problem, I'll take the meal back. You go back to the kitchen, no more vegetarian meals. Terrifying, terrifying moment. Not sure what I'm going to do. I did what was potentially the very worst thing you could do in that moment. I went back out. I took a plate from the vegetarian person and said, I'm really sorry, I'm actually going to need this for just 1 minute. Took the plate, went to the kitchen, cut it into two plates, put some other veg on, took them out to them, have a great meal, enjoy your time here. In hindsight, a terrible thing to do. It's an absolute true story. In hindsight, it was a terrible thing to do. And it's slightly awkward, slightly embarrassing because they ran out of food. That is nothing in comparison to what's going on here. It would have been hugely shaming to run out of something. Like, these were enormous events for the local community. They were enormous events to show something of themselves, something of the wealth of the family. And what they do is they run out. It would have lasted for days. And that probably communicated something of, like, we can't provide. We don't have the things, the resources to provide for the people who we've invited here. And not only that, but there's a crazy series of events that take place. Like, we're amazed by the water into wine, and it's right that we're amazed by that, don't get me wrong, but there is some extraordinary stuff that's happening in here. So I've picked up on three of them. Jesus says, woman, why do you involve me? Jesus replied, he says, my hour has not yet come. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. She's just been put down in some sense, and yet she's remarkably obedient. Do whatever he tells you to do. Do whatever it is. Complete blind obedience to whatever he says. She doesn't even know what he's going to do. She doesn't have a clue what he's suggesting, but she says, do whatever he tells you. And he tells the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim. He said something, so they filled them to the brim. Like, what were they expecting to happen? We read with hindsight and we get this idea of water into wine. We get this cool idea of what's about to happen. They had no idea. So they filled them to the brim. It's totally nuts. Then he told them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. And they did so. Like, for us to try and get into the mindset of what they would have been thinking, they would have been shaking with fear. Like, what is going to happen? We've got this dirty water that's supposed to wash people, and we're going to be taking it to the master of this banquet. Like, we're going to be fired at best, killed at worst. What are we going to do if this doesn't work? They have no idea what's about to happen. And the amazing thing is, this miracle takes place in the context of obedience. It takes place when Jesus commands them to do something and they do it. They have no idea what's about to happen. They have no idea why they've been told they need to do it, but they do it. And that's the context of this miracle taking place. This radical act of obedience leads to transformation. It leads to joy. It leads to a party. And just as a side note, I love that all throughout the Gospels, Jesus is mistaken as a drunkard. He's mistaken as a glutton for the people he hangs out with, for the way that he acts. And it's because the party is always surrounding him. There's always people gathered around him. There's always life where Jesus is. There's freedom. There's fullness of life. There's fruitfulness. And we see it no more so than in here. So I'll close with this. We see that God's being leads to God's doing. God's doing leads to our being, and our being leads to our doing. Jesus pronounces himself as, I'm the true vine, I'm the true Israel. I'm the one that we've been speaking about, I'm the one to look to. More than that, he acts out some of that. He acts out that he has fullness of life, that he has freedom. And he says, you're the branches, you're supposed to be connected, you're intrinsically linked to me. And when you do that, you will be fruitful. The true vine is saying, I am the real deal. Stay close to me. At the wedding at Cana, he's showing, I am the real deal. Stay close to me. And let me just finish with two things. The first is, there's a beautiful word for obedience in Hebrew. It's the word Shema. And when we translate it, again, what I said before of this word, obedience has almost been butchered by our language. We have actually quite a fearful idea of what obedience is. This word Shema actually means to incline your ear towards. It's about hearing, it's about listening, It's about softness. It's about trying to hear what someone's saying. Because when we do that, we can understand what they're obeying us to do. We're called to Shema. We're called to incline our ear towards what God is doing, what he's saying, what he's speaking over us, the truths that he would say over our lives. And I just want to ask three simple questions. Like, what do you want to hear God speak to you today? More than that, what do you need God to speak to you about today? And then probably the most challenging of them, like, what are you hiding from? Where have you heard God speak? Where have you heard the soft whisper of him in your life? And you've decided, you know what? That's too much for me. I'd rather hide than deal with what the reality of that is. So that's the first thing, to incline our ear towards. And the second thing, just to kind of keep making this point of obedience, is that Tom Wright says this beautiful thing about the vine. He says the pruner is actually closest to the vine when he's pruning. Like, we have this idea that us being shaped, us being formed, is actually this terrifying, distant God, and who's not willing to come near our mess. He's not willing to come near our brokenness. And in this analogy, in this image of the vine, what Tom Wright is saying is like, no, God's closest when he's near your brokenness. God's closest to you when you are being shaped, when I'm being shaped. Allow him to come close. Allow him to be close to you. Incline your ear towards what he's saying, towards what he's speaking over and of you.